I'm Christopher Lighton with the leading light of Pakistan's literary boom in English, Danial Munadin. A serious hit in America just when we need to know all those things about Pakistan that only a novelist will tell you. This is Open Source from the Watson Institute at Brown University, an American conversation with global attitude, we call it. Danial Munadin is a mango farmer in his father's Pakistan. He's a Yale-trained lawyer in his mother's America. The book that launched his writing reputation here is In Other Rooms, Other Wonders. It's a collection of linked stories about life in the feudal farming estates of the Pakistani Punjab in the present day. I have to ask you, Danial, first, is your farm flooded?
My farm isn't flooded. Just by chance, therefore what's happened is that the flood is about 30 kilometers away from us, the furthest sort of extent of it was. So I have many friends and family members whose farms are underwater, or I know people whose farms are underwater, but mine is not.
As a farmer by the Indus River yourself, I mean, have you got this disaster in perspective yet? What should we be learning from you about it?
I think that the thing that the world, I think, just doesn't understand is the scale of this thing. I flew back to Pakistan immediately after the flood began because I was concerned about my own property, which in 1973, the last time something like this happened, was underwater. And I was just staggered and completely overwhelmed by the size of this thing. I think this flood has the potential to be really transformational in that a place like Pakistan, which was so completely sort of disorganized and so completely vulnerable to real sort of, you know, revolutionary change, has now suffered a catastrophe which affects a huge proportion of the population. And I think this could be, is possibly, I mean, the impact of a flood immediately may not be that great. It's the long-term impact because, for example, when my farm was underwater in 1973, it took us something like 10 years to get back to where we were before. All of our orchard had been destroyed, the roads had been destroyed, a lot of the land was waterlogged. And so the tail of a catastrophe like the flood is huge. So as this thing plays out, it may seem to the Western audience that, oh, well, no, we've seen all the pictures of the flood and it's over and these guys are going to go back and clean up and it'll all be fine. That's not the way it works. This thing will go on for years and years and years, and this may be the spark that finally lights the sort of final fire.
Danial Munadin, I want to know what a Pakistani who could live anywhere loves about Pakistan and why you go back. What are the qualities of life in Pakistan that are in some way irresistibly attractive for you?
There are many aspects of Pakistan that, you know, draw me, and in fact draw me more than my attraction to any other place. Certainly one aspect of Pakistan that I love is the feeling of connection. That in Pakistan, one is connected to many, many people and many, many different kinds of people. My life is richer because I have all sorts of forms and aspects of engagement. In America, I feel that we all sort of live in these little icy cubes in which, you know, my primary attachment is to my wife and my brother and his family, perhaps. But I don't, you know, in the course of a day, I don't really meet that many different kinds of people. In Pakistan, which is such a stratified society, I meet, especially because of being a businessman, I meet all different kinds of people. And I feel as if, you know, I have the tug of that attachment from so many different directions. And that just makes life much richer and sort of fuller and more robust. Also, simply the landscape, the sense of color and vim and vigor and excitement. The place is crackling in a way. I mean, people talk about New York as being full of energy, but you haven't seen what full of energy is until you walk through the bazaar in Lahore and feel just this incredible sort of thriving, multiplying life. And so those are certainly aspects of my attachment. Also, there's a sense that sort of the place is in trouble a little bit, and therefore one wants to be there, just as, you know, if you know, your friend is in the hospital, you might be drawn to go and sit with them and see them and check on them. So I think there's some of that too. And then, of course, there's the love of the place of my childhood and, you know, of my family. They say that most of your experiences have occurred by the time your significant experiences have taken place by the time you're 18. I have a feeling of nostalgia for my childhood that most people have, and that draws me back to that place again and again to sort of drink at those waters. And then finally, you know, this is the... I mean, right now I'm writing a novel which is set entirely in America and has no Pakistani characters. But in general, I think that that's the place that I write about. I find it, just as an artist, I find it fascinating to observe and to be, you know, immersed in this place that is so, you know, vital to who I am as a writer.
What of the culture, and especially the music? Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan, for example, but how much is that part of your life?
The culture is very much part of my life, not high culture, but low culture. I mean, quote-unquote low culture, because I don't live in the city and I don't meet or, you know, hang out with contemporary artists. Or, you know, I listen to the music, but I listen to it on CDs. But living where I do, I mean, for example, the culture of the shrines, you know, where these incredibly devout people, you know, go and, you know, pay their respects to the saints who are scattered all over the Punjab. You know, even in on my farm, there's a shrine to a saint. People come there and hang these little cradles on the trees because they want to have a son. And I just find that very moving. And the art on the trucks and the sort of embellishment of every surface. I mean, even the guy who has the little ice cream cart will have painted scenes all over it. Yes, and I find that culturally that very rich. And you know, sort of the tractor that's covered with, you know, little things that twinkle and the storytelling. I mean, people are storytellers in Pakistan. And the stories that, you know, people will tell you about this and that and the other. A man came to me the other day and was explaining to me about all the different kinds of snakes. And he said there's one snake that stands on its tail and bounces long. And there's another snake that if he bites you, if you rush off and drink water, then the snake will die. But if the snake rushes off and gets to drink water before you, then you will die. So it's sort of a race to the water. And there's another snake that runs along the grass in the morning, licking the dew. So just these sorts of little cultural artifacts I find lovely.
And what of the traditional Sufi music? It's old and brand new and Pakistani and very, very global these days.
Yes, no, I love the music. And you do, I mean, what I love also is that the music is really embedded in the culture. The music is tied up with their religious belief, and that means that it enters their lives in a really deep way. You know, so I remember I was walking on my farm late one night and hearing from far away somebody plowing a field, and he was playing, they fit these very loud stereos on their car and their tractors, and hearing from miles away Nusrat Fateh Ali Khan being played at incredibly high volume by some guy who was plowing his fields at night because it's cooler than plowing it during the day. And I found that very moving.
Daniel, there are three kind of overlapping zones that I want you to talk about. One is the immediate crisis, the flood, but also Pakistan in the sights of the American AFPAC policy, the political crisis.
Sure.
Second is the notion that's pretty widely held now that Pakistan, not Afghanistan, is the epicenter of the Islamist extreme threat, whatever that exactly means. But then third, there is this matter of the explosion of Pakistani writing. The new edition of Granta is one little example, but so many Pakistani writers to the fore now. I hope we'll get to all of them. I'd love to begin with your book, though, In Other Rooms, Other Wonders. I'm dying to hear the sound of some of these stories, some of these scenes in Pakistan in your voice. Would you pick a moment, almost anyone?
This is a story called About a Burning Girl, and in this story there's a corrupt judge whose wife has a servant that she's very devoted to, and the servant goes back to his house on leave, and allegedly burns his wife to death. And the wife of the judge tells the judge that she wants him not to go to jail. In Pakistan, all things are possible. And the judge, of course, knows how to get this man off. So he sends his steno, which is sort of his secretary, to accomplish this end, to get the man off. And this is a description of the steno, whose name is Mian Sarkar. The two steeds pulling my career rapidly forward along the treacherous road of the Pakistani judiciary are my wife and Mian Sarkar. Each is, in a different sphere, absolutely matchless. My wife, you already know. Mian Sarkar deserves not merely a thumbnail, but a biography in two volumes, if it were possible to find out anything at all about him, except his present rank and station. So far as I am aware, Mian Sarkar wore a cheap three-piece suit and a pair of slightly tinted spectacles of an already outmoded design on the day that he emerged from his mother's womb. When he leaves the office in the evening, exactly at 5, he doesn't turn a corner or get into a cab or a bus. He simply dematerializes. No one knows even what quarter of the city he lives in, much less his address. He drinks nothing but milk, one careful glassful each day at lunch, and because of his digestion, he eats each day only a single cheese sandwich on white untoasted bread with the crust cut off, brought to him by a boy from a tea stall. Before speaking, he clears his throat with a little hum, as if pulling his voice box up from some depth where he secretes it for safekeeping. His greatest feature, however, is his nose, a fleshy, tubular object gorged with blood, which I have always longed to squeeze, expecting him to honk like a bus. That would be a fatal act. There is nothing connected with the courts of Lahore that he has not absorbed, for knowledge in this degree of detail can only be obtained by osmosis. Everything about the private lives of the judges and of the staff, down to the lowest sweeper, is to him incidental knowledge. He knows the verdicts of the cases before they have been written, before they even have been conceived. He sees the city panoptically, simultaneously, and if he does not disclose the method and the motive and the culprit responsible for each crime, it is only because he is more powerful if he does not do so. Locked in his impenetrable bosom are all the riots and iniquities of the past and perhaps of the future. And when his mild figure steps out of the law courts of an evening and is lost in the crowds along the Mall, I am irrationally reminded of Lenin disembarking at the Finland station in 1917. He is a man of secret powers and a mover of great events. This is the bacillus my wife sent to resolve Khadim's case as she wanted it resolved. Mightier men than I fear him.
Of course, he reads the scene like a book when he gets there.
Exactly.
And gets the servant off and...
Totally gets him off.
Damns his brother.
Exactly. All things are possible in Pakistan.
Beautifully done. I am rationally reminded of Salman Rushdie somehow in that fantasy. Not just the nose, which he's expecting to honk like a bus, but the irony, the fun.
Well, obviously, Rushdie is somebody that all of us have drawn from and sort of raised under the umbrella of.
A sort of rundown feudalism is the problem in your stories. A stuck old order of ruthless rich folk and their mostly wretched dependents. Is that Pakistan's problem?
No, I don't think so. I mean, I would disagree with your characterization of the sort of old feudal aristocracy as ruthless. I think that one of the things that I try to show about them is that these guys weren't ruthless. What's happened in Pakistan is that sort of the head has been chopped off, more or less, and a new head has been put onto an existing system. The only problem is that I think that whereas the generation that, you know, grew up in India and who sort of ran things through the 70s and even through the 80s had a generally benign Western-inflected intention and a sort of code of responsibility, the new guys who've sort of been grafted onto the existing structure do not have the same sense of honor, do not have the same sense of responsibility. And so they have the concentration of power is the same,
yes,
but the identity and the motivating mind that is exploiting this power is radically different. And so what we're seeing is a very, very different politic.
Maybe the emphasis should have been on run down more than ruthless, but the farms, the people in your stories have lost the light of whatever they intended to do. They're not modern. They're not living to the old tradition either. It feels like a pre-revolutionary place.
I agree with that. I mean, my mother often used to tell me, three generations from shirt sleeves to shirt sleeves.
Yeah.
And what that means is that, you know, the sort of the generation who sort of, let's say, were born in the 1890s, 1900, 1910. My father was born in 1906. Hmm. That generation, you know, were the ones who made it, and they made it under the British, and therefore these guys were sort of infused with British sensibilities and British moralities. So these guys were the ones who sort of, because they worked with the British and effectively worked with the British, were able to accumulate power and accumulate land and honors and so on. The next generation were the ones who sort of, you know, enjoyed this in the 60s and 70s and 80s. The third generation, who are the ones losing it, are the ones that are described more or less in my story, I think. My stories, which, remember, my stories are set in sort of the 80s, basically, and maybe in the 90s. So this is not a contemporary view of, you know, picture of Pakistan. And now this third generation, who were enervated, have been replaced by a new generation who are much more ruthless, a new whole class who are much more ruthless and who have taken it effectively away from them.
But as I read these beautiful stories, and they're immensely captivating and transporting, I kept wondering, what is the relation between these situations, absentee landlords, kind of cheating account managers and servant class, unhappy poor people? What is the connection between that scene and the Pakistan we read about, the generals, the corruption at the high level, the assassinations in the capital, the Bhuttos and the contending families at the highest level,
right,
the ISI? What's the organic relationship between those two places?
Right. Well, I mean, you could almost think of the Bhuttos as sort of the link between the two. The Bhuttos, and especially the father, was sort of a renegade member of this class. And he was sort of, I think, the original betrayer of this class. And he's the one who sort of, starting in the 70s, put in a new kind of politic, which was much more ruthless. I think that the connection between these two groups, sort of that past and this present, is that the people who had controlled the levers of power in the 70s and 80s, you know, they created structures in which it was possible for power to be highly concentrated, and then they sort of abdicated that power just simply because they were they'd lost their will to dominate. There was a vacuum there, which was then filled in some cases by sort of, you know, the new ruthless class, which was, you know, new members of the old class who were willing to participate in a much more ruthless fashion, and also then all sorts of other people who flooded in.
You say ruthless about the Bhuttos. What of the, we never understood the connection with Harvard and the Kennedys and a kind of progressive populist veneer too.
That's the veneer. And this was this veneer of Harvard and Oxford and so on is what enabled them to bamboozle effectively the, you know, politicians and, you know, people who controlled power in the West, and therefore to augment their own power by garnering support from the West. Certainly that was true of Bhutto Senior. I mean, Benazir, who's, you know, was, you know, in the West greeted as this sort of this democratic figure. I always perceived that as something that would be sufficient to make a cat laugh, you know. You know, the idea that she was this liberal democratic figure was just ridiculous.
Tell us your own story, Danielle Mounadine, as a child of America and Pakistan who took his own fate and his own farm in his hand, so to speak.
Well, I was brought up in Pakistan until I was 13, then sent to a boarding school in the West, and then went to Dartmouth College. I graduated in 87, and at that point, my father, I'd been going back and forth to Pakistan at basically every vacation. My parents had divorced. My mother was back in America. And my father basically just told me straight that, look, I'm effectively losing control of this farm that I was hoping that you would own. And if you want to own this, you're going to have to go back and take control of it. It's not a particularly large farm. In fact, it's quite small, but it's a place that I had always loved deeply. And at that point, I was determined to be a poet and therefore decided that I would go to the farm and take control and write poetry every day and sort of someday set the world alight with my poetry. But what I hadn't anticipated is how incredibly difficult this would be. The managers of the farm had effectively declared independence. Each year they sent less and less money to my father, making various excuses, you know, bad crops and this and that and the other. And my father was very unwell and so increasingly unable to go to the farm. He lived in Lahore. The farm is, you know, 10 hours by road from Lahore, and he just wasn't in the shape to go there. The head manager of the farm had actually become a member of the provincial assembly, which means, the parliament. And he had managed to convince my father to give him powers of attorney on the basis of which he had begun transferring large areas of our land into his own name. Some of this land, quite a bit of it now, I never did regain control of, and he died, but his children, sons and so on still controlled his land. One day I said to his son, I try to maintain good relations with his son despite this history. I jokingly said to him, Chaudhry Sahib, I'm told that you control so much land. Where is this land? And he said to me, well, think of it this way. Wherever you have land, I have land bordering you. And that's the land he stole. So it took me a long
time. Does one get back stolen land in Pakistan?
You do not get back stolen land in Pakistan. So it took me a long time, and it was this incredibly stressful, but incredibly also, you know, vitalizing life. I was, you know, engaged in this, and I was 23 or 24 years old and full of this sort of the first vigor of youth, and fought with these guys really, you know, marrow and sinew.
Islam makes scarcely an appearance in your stories, much less Islamism. I wonder, does it make an appearance in your life in Pakistan?
Not really. I mean, our area is a Sufi area. We're Barelvis, which is a much more mild and sort of a form of Islam which is very much believes in live and let live. Up to date, and I hope that this continues, I have not really been in any way targeted or affected by it. Obviously, as the general situation has become worse and worse, which it has, you know, year by year, and as it's become more and more dangerous, I've had to be more and more aware, sort of situationally aware of the fact that there are bad guys around, and I don't want to attract their attention, nor do I wish to cross them. Simply because I live there. I live a very exposed in an exposed place. There have been a couple of incidents. There was one time when some of these folks occupied a piece of land that I was in the process of selling, and there was absolutely nothing I could do about it. I merely sort of tried to sort of put a Band-Aid over it by basically sending a man to them and saying, look, this is fine. And I was selling a plot of city land, and on that plot there was a part that was set aside for a park, and these chaps basically came and overnight just occupied the park and said, this is where we're going to build our mosque and our madrasa. And I simply said, well, that's good. I'm glad. I wanted some religious community to be here and have to their mosque, and I'm glad for it to be you. There was nothing I could do.
I love the Muinuddin sort of natural history of the growth of this kind of Islam. How did it happen? Why Pakistan? Why now?
The answer is very, very simple. In 1979, the Soviets occupied Afghanistan, and the Americans, as a part of their policy of containment and of pushing back against the Soviet Union, decided that what they needed to do was create an army in Pakistan of people who would be willing to fight against them. Obviously, armies that are ideologically motivated are much more powerful than ones that are not, as we are now seeing to our great cost. So with the aid of Saudi money and American money, vast numbers of what are called madrasas were built. Madrasas are basically training academies for extremists. They created a very effective army, which did defeat the Soviets, as we know. But and the problem was that once you create an army and you pull out, you lose control of it, and that's what happened. This all flows from the Afghan war, from the first Afghan war against the Soviets. The Americans created this army, and once the Soviets had been beaten, they sort of brushed their hands and said, "Thanks for the job, boys. Mm. We're out of here," and pulled back, and then didn't engage. And you know, they passed all these amendments which prevented them engagement in various ways, and they had created this monster. And this monster, and what's funny, what's hilarious, is that even at the time, some of the leaders to whom the Americans were pouring cash, like Hekmatyar. Even at the time, Hekmatyar was saying, "Our greatest enemy is America." I was there at the time, and I used to find it absolutely bewildering that the Americans would be giving vast amounts of arms and support of various kinds to a man who was basically saying, "We have a checklist, and the Soviets are number one on the checklist, but you guys are also on the checklist. You're number two." And of course, Hekmatyar and his allies are the ones who are now fighting against America.
Of course, we've heard this story many times. Always convincing to me, and yet it remains a kind of outlaw version of history. And it's certainly not acknowledged by anybody in the United States government then or even now that the United States, in the war against the Soviets, planted the seeds of this poisonous crop. What difference would it make if Barack Obama, say, announced to the world, "Oh, by the way, we sowed this whirlwind"?
Well, obviously, you can understand why no American senator will stand up and say, "We created these boys." That's just not very palatable to, you know, the average guy sitting in Iowa who's, you know, got a very much more simplistic view of things.
No, the guy in Iowa, I think, is dying to get straight talk on this. I really do.
America has had a extremely cynical foreign policy going back to Teddy Roosevelt and before. The idea that somehow America exports democracy is absolutely hilarious. That's never happened. We've almost consistently been on the side of the dictators and of the torturers and of the, you know, bad guys. America has, you can look at El Salvador, look at Guatemala, look at Nicaragua, look at Chile. The history of American intervention in foreign policy, it's a litany of crimes. We've basically supplied the torture instruments and fortified the forces that, you know, herded hundreds of thousands of people into jails and took them apart with pliers. This is a narrative that the guy in Iowa doesn't want to acknowledge.
I disagree. It's the guy in the Beltway that doesn't want to acknowledge it. It's the guy in Iowa, I think, who's got a son who could be drafted into this horror, who wants to hear straight talk. I'm very, very grateful to hear you state the case with such A, clarity, and B, to put the American Muinadeen acknowledged, yeah, it's us. Reduce it to a number. I mean, on a percentage, how much of the blame for the Taliban and Islamic extremism in Pakistan and maybe elsewhere should fall on the U.S. sponsorship of of the Mujahideen and the fighters against the Soviet Union?
You want this quantified, do you? I would say 50%. I don't know. How do you quantify something like this? This is a very, very, very long problem. The question is how, you know, what is the policy that can produce a better outcome? I don't know what it is. I think that fundamentally what has to happen is that, social conditions in Pakistan need to change. There needs to be less poverty. There needs to be population, curtailing the population growth. The genie is out of the bottle. I mean, these madrasas.
Which genie? Which bottle?
Of Islamic extremism. I mean, that seed which was planted has grown and grown. There are now, they say, you know, I've heard numbers saying there are 40,000 madrasas in Pakistan. Mm. The only education that's given is rote memorization of the Quran, without in Arabic, in which case most of the students don't even understand what they're memorizing. They simply memorize it. This is the ideal conditioning to make
These are native Urdu speakers
who don't speak a word of Arabic.
The way I learned the Latin Mass as a young Catholic.
Exactly, similar. I mean, there's no better training for brainwashing than to force somebody to, you know, memorize something that he doesn't understand, and then to say, well, this thing that you've memorized that I don't understand, you don't understand, this is what it means. And what it means, that what they're told it means, is sort of jihad. So, let's say that each school produces one student who is fully radicalized and is willing to die for the cause. That means you're producing 40,000 truly fanatic extremists each year. In 3 years, you've got a big army.
Well, you speak of walking away. The hindsight wisdom on Afghanistan is that instead of walking away, we might have imagined a 30-year plan of education, economic development, road building, you name it, at whatever level, you know, people decided they could afford. What would it mean not to walk away, but remain some sort of constructive, not occupying, not bombing, not drone warring presence in Pakistan?
Finer minds than I have been wrangling with this issue and not come to any satisfying conclusions. The war in Afghanistan and, by extension, essentially in Pakistan, has cost, you know, hundreds of billions of dollars. You know, the one intervention that can be made is using money. There are large-scale projects that could be made that would sort of alleviate the suffering, or, you know, whatever word you want to use, of the average Pakistani. For example, dam building, road construction. If I were an American policymaker and were trying to figure out what intervention I could make that would be most effective,
yeah,
I would say power. Power generation. Pakistan right now, in Lahore, we have 1 hour of electricity on, 1 hour of electricity off. At my farm, we have maybe 3 or 4 hours electricity per day. And this is at numbers that have gotten worse and worse and worse and worse over the years. Think of your rage if it were 120 degrees out and you couldn't run a fan. And think of the kind of sense of disorder this creates. That, you know, at night, the bazaar is tipped into darkness every other hour. You know, that is what you want to do is create a sense of stability and order and then build on that. You know, good roads so that every time you go to market, you don't have to drive through potholes the size of Volkswagens. These kinds of interventions can be made. And obviously, there's going to be corruption. There will be. But that's part of the cost of doing business in Pakistan. So these kinds of interventions should be made. And then it's a question of, you know, of just how can you make interventions using money in Pakistan that will improve the life of the average Pakistani, whatever an average Pakistani may be. Mm. That's certainly the direction I would be thinking in.
You know, I imagined a kind of conversation between Daniel Moinuddin of Yale and Dartmouth in America, talking to his other self, Daniel Moinuddin of Lahore and the Punjab. Are there two mentalities, two experiences, two kinds of loyalty inside you that sort of debate these issues?
Well, I think there are, because there is... at a much larger, you know, at a macro level, a sort of partnership between Pakistan and America. And I'm frustrated by the behavior of both partners. And yet I feel, you know, responsible on both sides. So these are conflicts which are internalized for me.
Critique them, if you will.
Well, I think that in Pakistan, there's this tremendous corruption in their largest sense of the word. And in America, there's this sort of cynicism and also failure to understand the situation. And, you know, you sort of see it's, you know, these two forces, neither of whom are helping to improve the situation, really.
Do you know why?
It's the history that we've been talking about, you know. I mean, it's a history in which America was complicit in the corruption, and the corrupt were implicit in misinforming the American foreign policy establishment. They sort of played each other, and there was real misunderstanding, and there still is real misunderstanding. I mean, when I hear things that the guys on the ground say, I won't give examples, but I've just been amazed and flabbergasted. I had dinner with this person from the I was at a larger dinner in which there was a member of the embassy staff present, somebody whose opinions are valued, apparently. And this guy gave this long talk about how, you know, the corner has been turned. And I just thought this was hilarious. And that very evening, driving back to the place where I was staying, at sort of 1 in the evening, I came through this small town, and there was this mass rally taking place in which, you know, sort of basically, I didn't hear this exact words, but it was basically death to America, death to America. This sort of thing that we heard in, that you saw before the revolution in Iran. And I just, it was such a wonderful sort of contrast between the, it was just this mind-boggling misunderstanding of the situation.
So much of the problem lies in this incredibly unhappy but lucrative, essential pipeline of money between our Pentagon and the Pakistani military, which seems more or less transparently to run the country. What's the prospect of breaking that up?
I think none. I mean, realistically, partly because I think that having created, you know, essentially for the Americans, having created this force, which is sort of loyal to their Western, you know, ideals, more or less, they can't afford to cut that loose. You know, if the army loses power, I mean, who knows what's going to come out of the cauldron? So the America is committed to, and I think will remain committed to, preserving the preeminence of the Pakistan Army. And that's probably a wise decision. I mean, unfortunately, at least...
What would happen if Pakistani democracy were free to find its own level?
What does that mean? That's an impossible scenario. There's no such thing as... you can never, again, create a vacuum in which this animal called Pakistani democracy is allowed to flourish.
Really?
That was a long time ago.
Can you imagine how this monster would develop?
I think it might be hairy and slouching.
Because it would also be nuclear.
And it would also be nuclear, exactly. And these are chances that I don't think anybody in the West is likely to take.
That's fascinating. Does it make sense, Daniel, to think of containing Islamic extremism over a long term, as indeed George Kennan thought of containing the Soviet Union until a brighter day?
Well, first of all, I mean, you can't compare, because the Soviets were determined to contain themselves. They didn't allow their citizens to move outside the Soviet Union. The powers did not. They prevented news from coming in. So, you know, there was pressure from outside, but you could say that the pressure from inside was almost greater. Then remember, that was a different world. That was a world before communication became so easy. And then you have so many so many Pakistanis who have moved all over the world. There are communities everywhere you go. You can go to Tucson, Arizona, and find a thriving Pakistani community. So containment doesn't work for these reasons. And also, I think, because the project of the extremists in Pakistan is very much directed to the outside, to the West. I mean, there's a true intention to interfere in the sort of democratic processes and to somehow create this conflict. So I don't see it as being possible.
What's the shortest form you can give us for getting it right for American policy?
I mean, getting it right, what does that mean? You know, I think to sort of turn the tanker around and have it be slowly moving in another direction, if you're talking about that, about having, you know, what I've observed in all my time in Pakistan is a steadily declining, a situation which is becoming more and more violent and just tending more and more towards violent solutions. To turn that around means to, you know, simply to start creating civil society, to support the middle class, and to have the sort of more responsibility in the government, to have less corruption. And, you know, these are things that partly can be solved by, you know, in an intelligent way, by devoting money and attention to the problem. I think also a commitment to a long-term strategy.
It sounds like a pretty well demilitarized program.
Yeah, obviously I think that you can't solve this problem with guns and bombs. These problems have to be solved in other ways. It's a question of in trying to create a more nuanced financial intervention, and then in a very, very nuanced way, trying to sort of improve the lives of the average Pakistan, the life of the average Pakistani, as I've said. And that's, you know, it's an incredibly tough problem. I've seen this with, you know, these aid organizations who just, it's a tough environment to operate in. And there's profound misunderstanding from on the part of the humanitarian organizations. They try their best and they have very smart people there. It's a tough nut to crack.
Can we talk about books?
Let's talk about books. I'd much rather.
Granda has introduced me to Nadeem Aslam and Jamil Ahmad. I had already been introduced to Muhammad Hanif and his Exploding Mangoes and you and many more on the way. How's to account for this blossoming in the West of these voices from a country that we're scared out of our wits about?
Well, first of all, I would say, remember, three swallows do not a summer make.
You know, ten. Well, you've got a beginning.
It's, you know, obviously, it's a beginning. It's a lovely thing to see. But I think, in part, you have to remember that a lot of interest has been devoted to this group of writers simply because it is a country that's so much in the news and in which people are so deeply interested. So I think a lot of, you know, yes, there have been good, very good writers who've come out and come up, but I'm not sure that their literary productions would have been greeted with the same fanfare if they had been from, you know, Bolivia or Ecuador. So that's, I think, part of the answer to your question. I think the second answer to your question is that, you know, sort of there's a large or growing number of young people or middle-aged people who were educated, you know, who were educated abroad or educated in English and who are sort of coming into their stride. So, you know, you've got a large country of 180 million in which there's a sort of fairly large class of people who have been given the tools to write in English. You know, there are large numbers of Pakistani writers who just have not been translated and not really, whose work has not received attention in the West. These are people who write in English and who have the understanding of the Western idiom to write in ways that can be understood in the West, and therefore, you know, this blossoming has occurred.
Hugely instructive and welcome to me as a reader, and I think many, many more. I'd like finally just to talk about your stories and Chekhov. Other people have asked you about this. You seem to have feasted on Chekhov and inhaled something of his, what's to say, autumnal, subtle, subdued, kind of dove-colored tones in people and landscapes and the whole picture. I was also thinking, though, that Chekhov himself is often taken as a symptom of the end of an era, of a regime around 1900 that was beginning to come apart. Should we make that connection with your work?
Perhaps, but, you know, that's determined by the sort of political situation in which he lived and which I am living. And, you know, there are, of course, similarities between, you know, his situation, you know, what was going on in Russia at the second half of the 19th century and, you know, this milieu that I've been writing about, you know, a fading aristocracy and a possibly pre-revolutionary situation. But I think much more what I've taken from him is a sort of technical understanding of the short story. I mean, I think he's the greatest master of the short story. And, you know, I've tried very, very much to absorb his lessons. And these are lessons that can only be absorbed. You can't, you know, logically define them, really. It's about, you know, empathy and sympathy. And that's, you know, that's something that I've striven to emulate simply by reading him again and again.
Is Pakistan in a pre-revolutionary phase?
By pre-revolutionary, you mean the revolution is going to happen. And if some sort of revolution does happen, then everybody will sort of point to all these factors that were leading to it. But if the revolution doesn't happen, then it'll be just sort of a boiling up that went away. Nobody can predict that, I don't think.
Not even Chekhov.
Not even Chekhov. I mean, we certainly there are many forces that are tending towards revolution, but there are obviously forces that are, you know, opposing that, and nobody, I think, can predict which will come out on top.
Nobody but the novelists, Daniel Wendedin, in my experience, can give us the flavor and the depth and the interest that you do. And I just want to thank you for your work and look forward to lots more of it.
Thank you very much.
Ben Mandelkern produced and edited this conversation. It isn't over until you feed back on our website, radioopensource.org. I'm Christopher Leiden. Thank you for being part of the conversation.